Well, thank you very much, and thank you to John and to Tom and Cedar for giving me the opportunity to present to you today. I feel a little bit like that fellow Chris Maston at the Eagles. You know, John Poynton, the last 3 years, has made this presentation, and he's a well-known guru in the West Australian business community, and I feel like I'm the young rookie in the table, and he's Chris Judd, who's left the table and left me to see if we can revive the fortunes. That being said, in order to get a bit of a view of what you know you're looking to hear today, I did have a listen to Juddy's presentation for the last year here, and I listened to it one to give me some context, but primarily to get a feel of what remains pretty much the same from last year, and what has changed, and the same as John articulated in his presentation last year was very much you know the strong Western Australian economy, primarily off the strong Asian demand, and particularly China, the underlying demand for commodities and the fact that the prices are likely to remain, although not at their peaks, but at historical highs, the tight labour issues, and the performance in the capital markets and in the equities markets of businesses that are related to the cycle, so mining services businesses, construction businesses, those of the like, and I think a year on, all those messages remain the same. But it was interesting that if I listened to it, what happens in a year and the impact on the business community and the impact on our sense of optimism changes. John sort of articulated that, you know, we're in a time in 2007 of very cheap money, which makes very expensive assets. We're now in a strong tightening of liquidity. We've had three or possibly four rate rise increases in the last 12 months. Global debt markets are very tight. And in Australia, we look to see, you know, possibly two or maybe three in the next year that of interest rate rises. He highlighted the role of private equity, which was very topical 12 months ago, and how private equity have an impact on corporate valuations, and that the valuations that the public companies, the stock exchange and valuations provide may be out of step with the ability of private equity firms to leverage on assets, get a higher return on capital. Well, I think today we don't hear about private equity. If I ran through the weekend financial review, there was no articles on private equities, and companies such as Elko Finance and Babcock and Brown and all those financial engineering companies that were so prominent a year ago are really completely out of favour now because of the current debt market. John said there were no major dislocating effects foreseeable in the American economy. And of course, and there was a significant increase in US investments in other jurisdictions. Well, of course, we've since had the subprime blow up in the US, and in the last 4 months we've seen Chinese and East Asian companies investing into companies such as Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley and Citigroup, you know, all icons of the American financial system. So with that in mind, I've sort of entitled my paper today, The Economy or the Markets, Who Do We Believe? And just for a little bit of context, this is not a promo for Euros, but just a 2 second of the space that we practice in. We're a West Australian broking and corporate advisors house. We focus on what we call the mid-cap sector in the Australian market, and that is companies with a market capitalisation between 100 million and, say, about $2 billion. So we don't really focus from a West Australian context on Wesfarmers or Woodside, but we do focus on the Cloughs and the Ark Energies and the Home Building Societies and the Nomads and those sort of guys that are really benefiting substantially of this massive growth in the WA economy. My paper today will be a little bit resource-centric. I think it's hard to avoid that. Some of it will be similar in what Tim had to say, but hopefully that just really reinforces the messages that are out there. So who do you believe? The start of 2008 has eradicated much of the gains on the ASX of the previous 12 months. The 7% fall on the 22nd of January was the biggest one-day fall in 18 years and was at the end of a 12-day losing streak, the longest stretch of negative days on the ASX since 1982. At the same time, the Australian economy is benefiting from strong employment, wage growth, which supports consumer spending, high commodity prices, which are underwriting corporate profits, and state and federal governments, as well as private enterprise, which is investing big on infrastructure. BHP has announced a hostile bid for Rio, which more than anything tells you that any company is not out of reach. And in valuing the Anglo-Australian miner at $165 billion, we see that the Chinese have now waded in, amazingly spending $16 billion in one night to take a 9% stake in Rio. While the deteriorating global outlook has undoubtedly increased investment risk in Australia, the economy is expected to remain relatively insulated from the US downturn, provided that Asia, and I mean predominantly China, remains strong. Inflation remains the clear and present danger to the Australian economic prosperity, and with the RBA raising rates to 7% on the 5th of February and Monday signalling it could be two more in this year. Core inflation is sitting above the RBA's core target levels, and so Australia now really does have a significant inflation problem to manage, with growth remaining strong, and particularly in Western Australia. Economic prosperity continues in Western Australia, which recorded 6.3% annual growth, the fastest of any other state, and more than twice that of the national average of 3.2%. The commodities boom is fuelling state income, and at November 07, WA produced over a third of Australia's merchandise exports. Labour market conditions remain tight, and going forward, the WA economy is expected to remain strong, despite many base and precious metals reaching cyclical peaks. Big price rises in bulk commodities and energy are expected to underwrite further investment in Western Australia. Just thought we'd have a quick review of the commodity outlook out there. And I think we split the commodities at the moment into balance-based metals and the bullish bulks. And the major theme at the moment is the supply-side shocks that continue to be the major driving force in record prices and will remain so as long as China's insatiable appetite for energy and raw materials and agricultural products remains. Base metals fell considerably in 2007, but what needs to be taken into account is that these falls have emanated from extremely high peaks. Current prices are still at historically high levels, and the biggest concern is clearly the depth and duration of any downturn in demand and their impact on those base metals. All face downside risk from a slowing economy, economic growth in the developing world, particularly the US, Europe, and possibly that supply disequilibrium retreats to a more balanced relationship that we've had in the past. The bulks, on the other side, are very different. WA, which is strongly exposed to iron ore, thermal coal and coking coal, all look to set to enjoy record prices in 2008 and looking like hitting their cyclical highs. Serious infrastructure bottlenecks combined with recent supply disruptions, particularly in South Africa and China, have pushed coal prices to record high. And adding to this, Indonesia, the world's largest thermal coal exporter, is considering limiting coal exports to 70% of the country's output due to rising domestic demand. Iron ore prices, as Tim said, they're at record highs and expected to be for the rest of this year. The consensus that we looked at, somewhere between 50 and 60%, is expected to increase this year, which is on top of major increases in the past. There's some rumours around that the sort of Chinese are waiting back to see if there's any impact from the FMG ramp-up, which is a pretty risky strategy, bearing in mind it's an unproven structure and an interesting resource. Australian producers don't look like they're going to succeed on getting a price differentiation for transport. However, where the spot sales sit at the moment, being three times over FOB contracted sales, Australia is highlighting there's some chronic shortage in iron ore, and that these price pressures will remain. And that supply-demand imbalance is expected to remain in the short term, with delays in the Pilbara expansion and ramp-up and domestic Chinese iron ore production slowing down. The outcome of the BHP and the Rio transaction and the Vale and the Xstrata transactions will have a significant influence on where the price of bulks go in the future. And I think that the outlook for the energy sector remains similar. We've teetered on $100 barrel oil, And whilst there's some retreat from that, every time there seems to be a retreat to around the $88 level, it seems to bounce straight back. Australian industry has been somewhat fortunate that some of those costs are insulated by the high dollar, but on the same token, Australian producers haven't benefited from a low dollar and high oil prices as they would have done in the past. The strength of the Australian dollar and the continuation of relatively cheap gas, particularly in Western Australia, means that it's playing a great impact on our competitiveness in the global markets. Climate change is something I think that is also having a big impact on prices. Drought conditions for the second year in succession in Australia have meant that global grain productions have decreased while demand, particularly in East Asia, have gone up. World grain prices are again expected to increase this year and to record highs. Wheat prices have risen since mid-2007, with the world indicator price to forecast an average of US$310 per tonne, which is up $100 in the past year. Global inventories of wheat are expected to fall to 110 million tonnes, which is the lowest global inventory since 1978. And despite record production for coarse grains, such as corn, price of these grains are coming under pressure, particularly with the increased use of coarse grains in biofuels and ethanol. But weather's always been with us. And the only impact I think we see at the moment is that in recent times there's been some significant surges in short-term prices as a result of weather conditions. Hurricanes a year and a half ago in the Gulf of Mexico affected oil production and oil prices. Floods in Queensland and New South Wales and snow in China have impacted on coal production, and drought in Australia has impacted on grain production. While weather is not a new event, it is providing a unique challenge in the current environment, where short-term supply shocks in one region can have a significant impact on global prices. So with record prices still fueling the Australian economy, why do we see so much uncertain times in the stock market? Global money supply is tightening, largely on the back of the US subprime failures. Inflation remains the challenge, and Australian confidence can never be fully insulated from the events that happen in the US. So the question that inevitably is raised is, does the market's recent downward trend reflect a view that there's an imminent slowdown, which will mean the end of this current resources cycle? Can we have an economy growing at record price while the market teeters on implosion? Share market slumps often precede economic downturn because a lot of the pricings and earnings are based on forward earnings and an outlook for the future. We need only look into the 90s and 80s that we see a share market slump, particularly in 87, followed by a significant downturn in the market. However, I think in Australia and what we've seen in more recent times is a reasonably resilient market. Whilst we react to the shocks of the overseas economic news, in most of the cases you'll see there, in the middle of 07, and again, to some extent at the moment, there have been some resilience and bouncing back. But to look at the ASX and the impact on the Australian equity markets, we need to see where the root of the current ills are. The Australian economy is not on the verge of recession, and many of our leading companies are benefiting from a period of record commodity prices. The initial market fall of 10%, followed by a single-day drop of 7%, triggered a large number of margin calls, adding to the financial stress of investors. Exacerbating this was the forced selling of stocks that brought the undoing of companies such as Centro, Elco Finance, MFS and others, and particularly some of those financial engineering stocks which could no longer rely on the cheap money and the high leverage to perform or to outperform the market. And in recent times, Australian institutional investors have all been subject to these stocks. Stocks such as Elco, Rams, Credit Corp and Ram Home Loans and some of the Babcock and Brown satellites have lost in excess of 80% of their market capitalisation. Many institutional investments have been exposed to all of these. And the multiplier effect of the earnings shocks, the tightening credit crisis and the margin lending associated with these companies has seen them fall completely out. I thought I'd just put a quick slide there on some of the performance of those stocks. The ones along the bottom are MFS, Elco Finance Group, Credit Corp, Rams Home Loan and Centro. And you'll see from 100% base, most of those are fitting between 0 and 20%, and that is in a six-month period. And there's a large impact on Australian institutional investors as a result of that. The correction was savaged across the globe and prompted the US Feds to cut their rate initially by 0.75% and following another week by 0.5%. taking the further funding rate to 3%, the lowest since 2001. Even after 9/11, the Federal Reserve only cut their rates by 0.5%. So it is an amazing cut in a short period of time to try and refuel the US economy. And the importance of this move is that it steepens the US Treasury yield curve, reducing the US Treasury bond yields and forcing investors to take some risk in return to go out there. While the Australian correction was large, relatively compared with other corrections, at 7%, it was the fourth biggest in a single day. In contrast to 87, we lost 25% on a single day, followed by drops of 7%, 6%, 6%, 6%, and 8%. So relatively, the correction, while large, wasn't in the same context as what we saw in 1987. So it's clear, the Australian market is simply not moving in step with the Australian economy. The falls have done much to dampen the confidence that The Australian economy and the developing East Asian economies are somewhat disconnected from the US economy and will continue to grow in spite of the world's largest economy. The much-touted decoupling theory, which is not simply regarded as a cyclical trend. Structural forces such as sustained investments, spending boom outside the US and internal Chinese domestic demand are driving global economic forces and giving it some longevity. However, particularly in Australia, while it may be possible over the short and medium term for Australia and East Asia to experience some booming economy, nothing was dumped faster, I should say, than decoupling theory, except for the Australian share market at the time. This slide here is really just a demonstration, particularly of resource stocks from a period of 1 January to 6 February in an environment of strong commodity prices. Fundamentals remain strong, and yet of those companies that I've taken a poll of, there's only four that have performed positively, and two of those are subject to takeovers. Institutions and funds have been forced to sell and particularly to cover their positions, and now we focused on value recovery stories where their positions have been oversold. However, consider this. The situation is clouded in Australia, where the RBA continues to raise rates, forcing the convergence of equity and bond yields. This will likely lead to uncertainty in the Australian market until clear guidance is given to receive from the US to avoid a recession. So the key themes for moving forward, and I think we're into a very interesting period for the next 2 weeks. Since the subprime impact and the impact on the Australian share market, the next 2 weeks will see most of Australian companies producing their half-year results. Australian investors will be looking for two things: the quality of the earnings and the outlooks for the future. So there'll be a qualitative and a quantitative review of how these companies look forward. Some of the companies have already reported, and so far, most of the companies have done okay. They're cautious, but not gloomy. BHP posted its first year profit decline in 5 years, but this was somewhat ignored in the light of the Rio takeover tilt. Irrespective of the current market weakness, many companies have done or expected to post strong results, and particularly when you look at them via their current trading multiples, which have come back in the last 4 weeks. No results are yet completely disastrous, but you'll see those misses on the right-hand side there. Each of those companies that have produced average or below-market results have been savaged. United Group, which is a market darling for the last 5 years, reduced their growth forecast from 30% to 20%. A 10% drop in growth forecast result in a 30% drop in their market capitalisation. So it's just not a good time to come out with some less than good news. Someone like JB Hi-Fi yesterday produced a 17% increase to a record profit and a strong outlook, but the market took a view on consumer spending and put them down 14% on the day. Another key theme, I think, for 2008 is this decoupling theory. I touched on it earlier. So what does it mean? I mean, it means that theory suggests that Europe and Asia, and particularly China, need not slump just because the US does. This has massive implication for Australia, which counts Asia as far more significant trading partner than the US. So with that in mind, how has this theory been travelling? So far, pretty well. Despite some confidence indicators being knocked around recently in Europe and Asia, overall the outlook for these economies remains in a sound footing. Many countries in Europe and Asia regions were under inflationary pressures, so some of the slowdown sort of has come at probably the right time. This is especially relevant in China, where fundamentals remain strong and domestic demand continues to drive their economy. History suggests that China exports could slow down in the face of the recession, but from where it's coming from, there's still strong economic growth. Many economists are predicting that China's domestic demand will remain robust and that the economy can grow by about 10% this year, down from 11%. But that's a 10% growth, which is still incredibly strong in the context. Another key issue for the year is, of course, inflationary pressures. In its monetary policy last week, the RBA indicated another rise was likely as early as next month and possibly another one in the foreseeable future. A combination of a further lift in the terms of trade, a tight job market and signs of a wages breakout all meant underlying inflation is likely to peak around 3.75% in the June quarter and won't come down to the 3% band until 2010. Despite the threat of a US recession, the RBA believes China, India and some of the other Southeast Asian economies will drive domestic demand and drive our economy. Proposed tax cuts will add money to the economy, which is already running at some capacity. Another key theme that we see in 2008 is the consolidation amongst the Australian resource companies. Expect 2008 to be a year of further consolidations in the resource sector, with Trina playing an increasingly active role. Resource companies have seen their share prices experience rapid growth over the last 5 years, with the S&P 200 index climbing 142% during the period and the resource index climbing 335% in the same period. Resource stocks have been unable to weather the recent US downfall, rising 8% in August compared to 6% fall in the market overall. But despite this, the sector's trading at about 14 times forward earnings, and with the BHP bid for Rio and Vale's approach to Xstrata confirming that no deals are beyond comprehension in this environment. And China's role in the Australian resource market is also very interesting. Outside of its demand and fueling of the commodity prices, China is looking further to invest. It got rebuked in its bid for Unocoal in the US and has now further taken the approach of tying up with some of the more developing nations or taking strategic stakes, particularly in some of the Australian resource players. China's buying power, and I guess its support for the decoupling theory to some extent, was apparent in the $16 billion acquisition of a stake in Rio by Chinalco and its significant investment in some of the US banks. The Chinalco acquisition in particular supports two key suggestions. China has huge cash reserves, which it's able to mobilise and will mobilise if it believes that the cash can help secure supply of resources. The possibility of a US recession is seen to be of little deterrence to him and thus supporting the decoupling theory that we talked about. There's been an increase in buying of shares in the Australian resource companies over the past 12 months, and should this decoupling theory be proved correct, it is unlikely these purchases will abate. In addition to Chinalco's investment in Rio, Chinese investment in Australian companies includes Sinosteel's investment into 20% of Midwest, Shougang's and its non-associated associates moving to a 40% interest in Mount Gibson, Non-Firmit partnering with the Indonesian government in a bid for Herald Resources, and Jishuan taking big equity positions in nickel miners, Allegiance Mining and Albedon. There's a clear message here that the Chinese economy growth is dependent on security of strategic supply, and that China is no longer willing to be a bystander and remain hostage to the large price negotiations it's had to in the past. Which leads me to a period that we come up forward in the next 12 months of the mega mergers. As I said, the BHP bid for Rio means that there's no company really out of anyone's reach. The BHP-Rio merger is set to remain a big story in 2008, and it's unlikely to be resolved until well into next year. Regulators in over 100 jurisdictions have to be appeased, and clearance will take at least 9 months. So how do we see this bid playing out? Well, it's early days. But by formalising its bid for Rio and adding an additional 0.4 shares to the equation, BHP has made an important step in taking power away from the shareholders' agents, being their directors and advisers, and putting the power in the hands of the shareholders. It needs to be considered that two-thirds of Rio shareholders also own shares in BHP. If the logic is compelling for a tie-up, with BHP identifying $40 billion in synergies are there. BHP also has a huge advantage over other rival bidders because of its dual-listed structures in shares with Rio, enabling it to offer both British paper and Australian paper to the group of investors. Further, a rival bid doesn't look unlikely. Chinalco's stake in Rio is likely to be designed to get a seat at the table rather than to make a full-blown takeover. By BHP setting a minimum acceptance of 50%, it sets a massive disincentive for anyone to try and claim a blocking stake. So it's to a large extent, it's not a question of whether BHP and Rio are a good fit. We know they're a good fit and they make great sense. It's really the ability of the Rio board to extract a higher valuation and for the BHP board to get an acceptance out of the majority of the Rio shareholders. Other significant bids out there at the moment, Vale, which is a former CBRD, have disclosed that they have been in discussions with Xstrata, which would be a $110 billion takeover. In any other environment except for the current one we're in with Rio and BHP, this would be front page news, but it has moved into the side a bit. The proposed merger is said to be an embryonic stage, but no doubt reflects that both miners being concerned that they're going to be left behind in the wake of a BHP and a Rio merger. The story is much the same with Microsoft and Yahoo in Seattle, with the Seattle-based company going hostile in its attempt to keep up with Google and end its market dominance of the global search engines. Google has countered with an offer to Yahoo to jump into bed with it and form a strategic alliance, and secure a valuable stream on the online customers. All these three takeovers, or potential takeovers, will dominate global and to a large extent Australian business over the next 12 months. I was interested that Tim had the Smiley Index too, because I hadn't heard of it before I prepared for this speech, and now I've seen it twice in a day. It's the Chicago Board of Options Exchange Volatility Index, and to some extent it's a measure of fear. It's considered that it's the major indicator of investor sentiment out there. And a spike in the index is often a sign that the market has bottomed and that the confidence is returning. You'll see there was a significant spike in the index in January, and it's been the highest point that it's reached since 2001. So the takeaways. Commodity prices remain strong, and the outlook for the Australian economy is resoundingly positive. Inflation and its impact on interest rates remain key, particularly in the tightening global credit market. China continues to outperform year on year, and the strength of its domestic demand and investment should soften the impact of any further fallout in the US. The decoupling theory is set to be proved real. The January correction has meant that many of the shares in the resource and energy and mining services company are now trading at far more attractive multiples, which provides a conducive environment for mergers and acquisition. I think over the last year or so, some of the multiples that are associated, particularly with some of the mining services and the contracting businesses, mean that there are great mergers available there, but on an EPS basis and trying to put them together, they're very difficult. The correction on some of the relevant PEs in those businesses mean that those mergers can now proceed. And from an institutional investment perspective, there'll be a high focus on recovery stories. Stories where the positions have been oversold, but the remaining business remains strong and have just been linked to the seller. Thanks very much.